how do I pronounce the full name of Maru?
Maru Faiseur de Chocolat.
Will you say again?
Maru Faiseur de Chocolat. So faiseur is a funny word. It's a funny word. It comes from the verb faire, which means to do. So it's like maker. It's more like to do than to make, as in, you know, somebody comes up to you in a party and they say, so what do you do? And you say, I do chocolate.
That's fantastic.
This episode of the Slow Melt Maker series is sponsored by Cacao Cucina, the control you need to craft your chocolate. Reliable chocolate making machinery built in the USA. Use SlowMelt10 at cacaocucina.com. Contact us for a 10% discount through September 1st. This episode is also supported by Chocolate Alchemy, supplier of the largest selection of fine flavor cocoa beans, chocolate making equipment, and volumes of free chocolate making information. They've been helping home chocolate makers and bean to bar professionals for over 14 years. Visit chocolatealchemy.com and enter SlowMelt at checkout to receive 10% off any retail cocoa bean order.
Welcome to the Slow Melt Makers series. I'm Simran Sethi, and today I'm speaking with Sam Maruta, the co-founder of Maru Faiseur de Chocolat, founded in 2011 and based in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. Sam, I've now gotten to speak with you a few times, and what we haven't discussed, even though we've covered a lot of ground, is your personal journey with chocolate. Can you remember the first time you tasted chocolate?
No, I don't think most people can remember, because it's usually something that you do when you're very small. So I can't say I can place a first chocolate experience, but I can remember fairly early chocolate experiences. I remember being offered for Easter a beautiful chocolate egg that I thought was too nice to eat. So I think instead of breaking and eating it, it just stayed and gathered dust in a cupboard for many years. I also have some vivid memories of a chocolate withdrawal syndrome. Because as I said, and probably like most kids in France growing up, there was always chocolate in the cupboard. So it was never really a question of, you know, are we going to run out of chocolate? But when I was about 10 years old, I went to Japan on a trip for a whole month, and I was by myself visiting relatives in Japan, in Hokkaido. And I think at the time, chocolate wasn't such a big thing in Japan. And I remember my French grandmother had packed a chocolate sandwich, so a piece of baguette with a bar of chocolate inside. And and she, you know, she'd packed a bunch, and one of them found its way to the bottom of my suitcase. And I think probably my third week in Japan, I discovered that chocolate sandwich at the bottom of my suitcase.
Oh, no.
It was still wrapped in foil. The bread was completely hard. It wasn't, you know, it was baguette, so it had just gone hard. But I remember going, oh, and just devouring the chocolate inside. It was so good.
Was your family watching you? Like, did your relatives in Hokkaido wonder what was wrong with you?
No. I think I did that in the secret of my bedroom.
Smart man. Yeah.
Plus, I didn't want them to feel bad that they weren't probably feeding me the stuff that I wanted. Or no, it was pure joy.
And you probably didn't want to share. I mean, you know.
No. No way.
Okay, so let's talk a bit about Maru. One thing that really struck me when we spoke earlier was how you described how you and your partner, Vincent, entered into the company and decided to start making chocolate in Vietnam.
You know, sometimes I think the timing is right for something. And back in 2010, I was already living in Ho Chi Minh City, but I just quit my previous job, and I met Vincent just almost immediately after quitting my job, and he'd quit his job, and we were in this happy position of being people who are unemployed, but you know, it's not because we've been fired. It was our internal clocks, our internal job clocks had decided that it was time to look for something a bit more interesting. And so we were exactly in the same position, pretty much on the same wavelength in the sense that we wanted to have some sort of entrepreneurial adventure, and we wanted to do it in not for money, but more for, it's probably pretentious to say lifestyle choices, but I think that's what it really was. We wanted to create a company and do something that would fulfill our lives in mm-hmm. as many ways as possible. And so when we met, of course, we didn't start talking about that straight away. First, we had to become friends. The actual story that we keep repeating, and I'm sure people doubt it. They think it's probably not true. We met on a jungle trek. We were doing this thing in the jungle outside Ho Chi Minh City, and we met on the bus going to this place called Thac Mai, where we spent 48 hours in the jungle, drinking filtered water and eating whatever we could catch in the river.
That's bonding, yeah.
Yeah, it was a good bonding experience, and there were a bunch of other people on that trip, and some of them are still around. Then we kept bumping into each other in Ho Chi Minh City, which is a very large city, but also a bit of a village if you're in the same circles, and then eventually we found that we had a common interest in not just creating a company, but also in working with cacao and possibly chocolate. So that's what led us to start the business together, because it's always easier if there's two of you.
So talk a little bit about that. Where did the interest in cacao come from, or what was your intended goal in working with cacao?
Well, we didn't exactly do what you'd call a market survey, but from my point of view, mm-hmm. I'd been in Vietnam for a few years already, and I thought the people who had the most fun as foreigners doing business in Vietnam were the people working in coffee. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting, because they're working in this market. There's a bunch of them. Vietnam is a huge producer of coffee. They go to the countryside. They get to, you know, ride around in pickup trucks, and instead of being stuck in an office, they actually work with something tangible. But the coffee business seemed saturated, and there are already way too many companies and people with a lot of expertise dealing with that. Mm-hmm. So when we found out there was cacao in Vietnam as well, we thought, well, that's a less intimidating sector. There's fewer people involved in it. There's probably some room for people with zero experience like us. And that was kind of the bet we made, that, you know, no one would realize that we didn't know anything about cacao when we got started.
But they would know if you had been in France. This is what you shared with me earlier. If you'd been in France, you couldn't have, I mean, the legacy of being a chocolatier or a chocolate maker would have probably kept you from doing that. Am I remembering that conversation correctly?
Absolutely. And because I'm just talking about the cacao sourcing here, because chocolate making was virtually non-existent in Vietnam, except for a few maybe very large industrial companies that had some transformation facilities in Vietnam. But that was not the scale that we were aiming for. There was nobody really making chocolate the way we're making chocolate now at the time in Vietnam. Even now, there's very few.
So who did you seek counsel from if you hadn't had any experience making chocolate and didn't have any models in Vietnam?
Well, I think, you know, like everybody else of our class, as in, you know, born in 2010, 2011, I think we found inspiration and information and not always accurate, but on John Nancy's Chocolate Alchemy website. I think there was a big thing. There was also the Chocolate Life from
Clay Gordon.
Yes, Clay.
So Clay's site, John Nancy's site, those were sort of the guides early on.
Yeah, those were the sites that we turned to when we thought, well, how does one make chocolate? That wasn't the most difficult part, I think. Mm-hmm. Once you get really involved in it, you know, you know you have to roast the cacao, you have to do the winnowing, you have to do the grinding, you get your premier grinder, and then you can actually grind chocolate, and then you have to figure out how to temper chocolate. That was slightly more complex from a technical point of view, but still something that's doable. But what we did, and probably that's a bit different from a lot of chocolate right. makers or budding bean-to-bar chocolate makers, is that we also spent a lot of time in the countryside trying to find cocoa beans directly at the farm and educated ourselves in sourcing cacao. I think that was very, very important. So we bought a cut test, you know, one of those guillotines, the things that mm-hmm. slice the beans, and we spent as much time as possible with people who were working for NGOs, agronomists, people who were giving advice for the cacao farmers in Vietnam.
And what were the parameters that you were looking for as you became more knowledgeable about beans? Were there particular flavor profiles? Were there certain regions that you wanted to help grow? What were the defining reasons you sourced from one area over another?
Well, the thing is, in the beginning, we thought, well, we should have enough. And then we thought they'll be good and they'll be bad, and we'll make one type of chocolate. And then we realized that when we were traveling to different places, we found beans with different flavor profiles. So we thought, that's actually more interesting than we thought it would be. You know, we can start playing with these origins, and that's how we came up with different bars attached to different origins and that have different flavor profiles.
Wow, so that revealed itself to you as you did the research and the field work.
Yes.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So you source all your beans in Vietnam. Would you ever consider sourcing outside of the country?
Well, it's something we've thought about, but I think that the brand Maru is so entwined with the single Vietnam origin that it would be difficult. I think if we were ever to do that, it would probably be under a slightly different brand name.
Okay, got it. There was something that you wrote in your post on your website on the history of cocoa in Vietnam that really struck me. You said, at the end of the day, certification is by definition a bureaucratic exercise, a set of norms put in place, standards to verify the norms are being upheld, and be able to bury any query under a ton of paper. When you're dealing with a family or a farm that is just a couple of acres, has a few hundred cocoa trees, some other marketable crops, a pond for raising fish, a pig or two, and some chickens running around the vegetable patch, the whole thing seems absurd. Can you talk to me a little bit about that? I mean, it's clear that that explains why your chocolate isn't certified, but like, what was that born out of? Was there a moment when you're like, we have all we need?
No, there was frustration as well. When we started in 2011, we found a place in the Mekong Delta that we were being told was in the middle of being certified organic. So we were told, you know, that they started the transition in 2009, so by 2012 they will be certified. And we thought, well, that's great. The whole thing is that it was going to be certified through a co-op, and that the co-op was getting the funding for its certification from some Western NGO. So that so far so good. When we went back to the same place in 2012, we asked the farmers, so how's the certification coming along? And they were like, mm-hmm. well, we don't know. We're just farmers, asked the guys at the co-op. So we went and asked the people, the chairman of the co-op, and he said, "Oh, I don't know. You should ask the guys at the NGO level." So we asked the guy at the NGO level, and the NGO had a branch in Ho Chi Minh City, and he said, "Well, I don't know. You should talk to my boss in Hanoi."
Gosh.
So Hanoi is like 1,000 miles away, by the way. So we did have a chance to fly to Hanoi, and then when we got to Hanoi, we asked, "So what's happening with the certification project there?" And they're like, "Oh, well, we don't know. We think that maybe it's not going to happen." So I think somewhere along the line, and I'm not going to start blaming one person or organization rather than another, but it was completely disconnected from the farmer's experience, and that whole certification thing was a failure. I think we were given several answers for that. Some of them ranged from the, "Well, it doesn't make any economic sense," which we thought was not convincing, to the, "Oh, somebody botched the paperwork, so the certification is not going to happen for bureaucratic reasons," which seemed quite likely to have happened. But the bottom line is it did not happen. Mm-hmm. The bottom line, again, is that because the co-op was not providing the members of the co-op with anything that was adding value, the members of the co-op kind of resented it as a sort of parasitic organization. And so the essentially, the co-op became an empty shell that didn't buy and didn't sell anything. So we're still working with the farmers, and at the farmer level, you know, nothing's really changed. People continue growing cacao. We continue monitoring the quality, paying more for high-quality beans. But the whole organization and certification part of it has kind of disappeared, and in a sense, at the scale that these people are operating, I think it was pretty much a distraction.
So would you ever try again? I mean, this sounds like it was one experience that didn't really work out, but was it a defining?
Yeah, I think you have to also look at something, which is the history of Vietnam. Mm-hmm. In Vietnam, April 30th is a public holiday. That's a day of the reunification of the country, which celebrates the day in April 30th, 1975, when the Vietnam War ended. So what happened after 1975 is that there was a brief, about 10-year experiment in collectivization of agriculture. And that's been fairly traumatic. It was abandoned in 1986, but for this period of 1975 to 1986, a lot of the farmland in Vietnam underwent forced collectivization. So people were being told that they no longer own land, that they had to work for what worked as state farms that were like co-ops that were enforced on people. So the generation of farmers that we're working with have been through that, or their parents have been through that. It's been fairly traumatic. So selling them on the co-op idea is never easy. They'd much rather have their own small piece of land and do their things, and they're quite happy with the sort of commercial relationship, which is, you know, we buy, we sell, I can buy to somebody else, I can sell to somebody else. They're kind of, you know, natural born free marketeers.
Thank you for clarifying that.
This episode is brought to you by Rotar Chocolate Machines, a chocolate grinder designed and built by a chocolate maker for chocolate makers and made in the United States. Get all of the details at www.rotar.com. This episode is also brought to you by Blue Apron, the meal delivery service that works directly with artisanal purveyors and family-run farms to bring meals to your door. Get $30 off your first order plus free shipping at blueapron.com/chocolate.
Let's shift gears a bit because I'm so excited to taste this bar with you. Tell me a little bit about...
Which one have you got? The Dak Lak?
The Dak Lak!
Yes.
I'm trying to restrain myself a little longer here. Tell me a little bit about the story of the packaging. The story before before we ever get to open up the bar?
Yeah, so we have six bars in our single origin series, and each of those bars has basically the same design, which is a colorful background with what I would describe as black windows on it, and it's all overlaid with a gold lattice and gold organic mm-hmm. patterns. So we wanted something when we created the packaging that would remind people of Vietnam. You know, if you looked at the packaging and you saw that, you knew it wasn't Japanese, you knew it wasn't Lithuanian, you knew it had to come from Asia, and the cues to its Vietnamese-ness are subtle, but you know, if you visited the Imperial Palace in Hue in central Vietnam, you'd see, oh yes, I can see the lattice work, and then there's the motifs of the cocoa pods and the stylized clouds and the cocoa flowers. So all of this, you know, being subtle cues that you have something that's made of cacao and it's made in Vietnam.
And a very overt cue that it's made in Vietnam is that you actually write the description in Vietnamese, which...
That's because you got packaging that was sent to you directly from Vietnam. It's each of these wrappers is screen printed by hand, so we actually have many, many versions of the same wrappers that we adapt for the countries that we export to. So if you'd gotten this bar at a shop in France, you would find the description at the back to be in French. If you'd gotten it in Germany, it would be in German.
Wow. Okay, well, it's time for me to open this bar, so I would love it.
Mine
I'm
is already
it.
Open. Okay. I skipped breakfast.
That's brilliant. Before the coffee, have the chocolate.
Yeah.
Tell me what I'm about to taste. Tell me about Doc Lock.
Simran, what's the temperature in your room?
The temperature in my room right now is probably around 69, 70 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right. So it's quite cool. I'm sitting, the chocolate I'm eating is at room temperature. There is no snap. It's not melting, but it's completely lost its snap.
Oh, wow.
And it's, so it's probably about 27, 28 degrees Celsius. I don't know how much that is in Fahrenheit. But
I don't either. I never can get that right. It's hot.
It's enough to sweat if you walk around. But anyway, I find that this sort of temperature actually expresses the flavor of the chocolate best.
Mm-hmm. Your temperature.
Yeah. And I found that, you know, of all the variables that you have, I think probably the temperature of the chocolate is one of the most important when you're sampling it. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. we've got people here in Vietnam who say, where should I keep my chocolate? And it's usually hot enough that, you know, you want to keep it in the fridge. But if you're keeping your chocolate in the fridge, which is fine, before eating it, you should take it out a few hours before.
Yeah.
It's almost like wine.
Right. I am letting this waft below my nose, this beautiful piece. Tell me about this region. Tell me about where this comes from.
Yeah, so Dak Lak is in the central highlands of Vietnam. The cocoa-growing regions are about 350 kilometers from Ho Chi Minh City. It's the furthest away that we go to source cacao at the moment. That means that when I go there, I usually take a plane mm-hmm. because driving would essentially take all day just to get there and then another full day to get back. It's an interesting region. Mm-hmm. It's on the border with Cambodia. For a long time, it was very, very wild. It was... during the French colonial times, it was not a place where so-called ethnic Vietnamese people lived. It was sort of tribal country, and so it's got a very distinctive heritage. It's the last place in Vietnam where you're likely to see elephants, both in the wild. There's very few of them left, but there's a few, and tamed elephants with. some ethnic groups that have a tradition spanning centuries of taming elephants and using them for work. Mm-hmm. So Daklag has this sort of far west feel to it. It's got a fairly low population density for Vietnam. It's got some beautiful sceneries, although unfortunately most of the jungle has disappeared except for the protected areas. And right now it's famous essentially for coffee growing. And in the middle of a sea of coffee, you find a few places here and there where some daring farmers are doing cacao. So we're working with these guys.
Tell me about the flavors. You describe on the bar, it's a spicy bar with strong earthy tones.
It is, it is. If you had the full range of all the different single origins we have from Vietnam, the fruity notes can be quite strong, quite extreme, in some bars like the Barilla, the red one. But there's some sort of fruit notes in most of the chocolates. But I think the Daklag has a different quality. It's more earthy. Sometimes it's got almost like hammy flavors. I don't think the bars we're tasting now have that. It's actually quite balanced, but you know, it's got that pleasant bitterness that is.
You know what comes up for me is tobacco. I really get this nice. It's like a.
Yeah.
It's not earth for me, like dirt, but earth like. I don't know, something coming from the earth.
Something about the leather and tobacco thing. It smells like an old gentleman's club.
Mm-hmm. In the best
in
kind
the best
of way,
kind of
listeners.
Way. I meant like a posh club in London, not not changing rooms at your local gym.
That's great. We have a completely different definition of gentleman's club in the United States, which is more... a little lustier, shall we say. So,
all right,
thanks
yes.
for that clarification. Yeah. The first, I remember when I first tasted a Maru bar, it was the Ben Tre bar. And
yes.
When you talk about spicy, I wasn't convinced that there wasn't an additional ingredient because it was so extraordinary. And it's your chocolates, the cocoa that's coming from Vietnam, that has helped me to really understand the wide range of flavors that exist in cocoa.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, we've had people questioning whether we put anything in the cacao to make it taste like that, and the answer is no. I mean, the single origin bars are two ingredient bars. I mean, with the exception of adding a bit of cocoa butter for the texture, but it's cacao and sugar, and the sugar is really quite plain. So the flavor comes from the cacao alone. And, you know, that's what we discovered when we started making chocolate, that cacao from different places had different flavor profiles, and therefore we got different chocolate tastes out of it. And that's how we got started on this range.
And even within the bar, it went from these sort of earthy tobacco leather notes to something really nice and chocolatey for me. I think it's always very subjective, but it's just, there's a real lovely progression here in what I'm tasting.
Yes, it's a bar that I like a lot, the Daklag. It's funny because we've sent it to a few competitions and it's never... It never brought back any silverware. And I don't know why, because I think it's a great bar, but I think maybe it's not to everyone's taste, or maybe on the contrary, it's too well behaved, as in it doesn't have the sort of distinctiveness of some of our other bars that make people kind of go, oh, out of five chocolates I've tasted, I remember this one because it had a really, you know, distinctive flavor profile. I think this one is very, very pleasant, but maybe a bit shy.
It's such an interesting description. It is a very eatable chocolate, and it's teaching you something, but it does feel a bit subtle. But I will say also, having judged competitions, that it's never five. You're always tasting so many different chocolates that it's quite a lot to take in, and I can see how that may have factored into it.
I must say, I could never do judging competitions.
Why is that?
I'm very easily influenceable, and I think I tend to agree with the last person who spoke. I think when it comes to my taste buds, it's even worse.
Oh my God.
So I saturate very quickly, and I have trouble. I'm not very comfortable doing this whole exercise of, you know, putting the chocolate in my mouth. So far, so good. describing how it feels nice, but then going into, you know, complex descriptions of flavors and notes and everything is something where I find that I'm very often out of my depth.
It makes me feel a lot better hearing you say that, because I'm so intimidated to be tasting chocolate in front of the people who made it. So yeah. You're not alone in feeling out of your depth there.
No
but
worries.
I feel, you know, I mean, it's so great to have the experience. I wouldn't trade this for anything. And I hope listeners will feel the same way. I mean, we're getting to hear the story from you while we get to taste this extraordinary bar. And that's really it. I mean, whatever you find there belongs to you, right? Belongs to me. Like, I don't actually think there's a right answer.
Absolutely. I find, you know, there's so much subjectivity in this whole exercise. So, but, you know, for me, the important thing is it enjoyable? You know, once you've opened the bar, are you going to finish it? If you had another bar at hand, would you open that other bar after that? Yeah. And that, to me, is a real defining thing, you know. How much of a draw you have for this bar, and how you enjoy eating it.
Right. I love that. So tell me this, what bars would you reach for? Not in your collection, but from other makers and manufacturers.
Oh, that's a tricky one. No, it really is. Because we get a lot of bars, you know, we exchange bars with other makers, and then we go to events. And usually I will fly to an event with my own chocolate, and then I'll think, oh, I'll have space in my luggage. And then I come back from Tokyo or Paris or Seattle, and my suitcase is full of other people's chocolate. So we have like a space in our R&D lab where we stash other people's bars. And
oh,
I have, you know, I've tasked some people to try and organize a collection, but it's not easy. when it comes to other people's chocolate, it really depends. I mean, you've got people that you can trust to make good chocolate on a consistent basis, on a regular basis, and we have many friends who do that. I think you said you were talking to cocoa hunters in Colombia.
So we
get a lot of things in common with cocoa hunters. Their approach to sourcing in the country from different places, mm-hmm. with different flavor profiles, very closely resembles what we're doing here in Vietnam. So I think that they're a good example of people doing a great job. And there's way too many brands that I could talk about. One that really surprised me recently was Hogarth from New Zealand. Very, very small bean-to-bar maker and very high-quality product. So mm-hmm. that was a very nice surprise. We get a lot of emails from people saying, hey, I'd like to make bean-to-bar chocolate. And then a few years later, you meet the people and you have their bar in your hand. And it's wonderful to see that whatever advice you dished out at 2 a.m. By email has, you know, turned into somebody, you know, starting a business in New Zealand a couple of years later. So that was actually great.
So what advice do you give to up-and-coming makers?
Usually it tends to be fairly technical. It depends on the level of knowledge people have when they start. But, mm-hmm. you know, it's stuff like, you know, can you make a business out of bean-to-bar chocolate if you shell cocoa beans by hand? The answer is no. there is such a thing as a minimum level of equipment you're going to need to get started and, you know, to make chocolate not just a hobby, but something that you can make a living out of. I tend to go for business advice because I can't really tell people, you know, how their chocolate should taste like. But generally speaking, I think that there's a lot of people starting making chocolate out of passion, and they're really into it. They need to find that, you know, they need to find a way to turn their passion into a viable business. And to make it into a viable business, you have to look at, you know, things like your costs and your sales price and how and your retail channels and how you're going to be selling your chocolate to whom. You know, obviously you have more of a market if you live in a large city with a high income than if you're in a in a place in the third world that's very isolated. At the same time, your production costs are not going to be the same. So there's not one correct answer. It depends on where you are and what your strengths are as a person, as a chocolate maker, as a business person.
You know, it's so interesting also that that's your counsel, because you mentioned that wasn't the motivation when you and Vincent started the company, that you weren't, you know, you weren't doing this for money.
Well, no, yeah, I'd correct that.
Okay.
We always thought of it as a serious business, mm-hmm. but, you know, the serious business and serious business, I think what we were not in for was a quick financial gain.
Okay.
You know, especially if you hang out with a lot of people who start their own businesses, a lot of people don't start business for fun. They've got a business plan and they say, well, in 3 years' time, I'm out of here. I've got an IPO, or I've got people who are going to buy my shares, or I've got an investment fund that's going to pour money in and will value my investment at X. And that's how I think 80% of business startups work, maybe not in the world of chocolate, but in general. And we had a different approach in the sense that we thought we're going to make this into a great business, but we want that baby business to grow into something bigger, but not for financial gain, because we want it to be something that, you know, mm-hmm. potentially we can leave to our children. And it's something, when you meet other chocolate makers, not the Bintu bar, mm-hmm. that, you know, we're all babies, but if you meet people from family-owned companies like Bona that have been around for 5 generations, you're thinking, how great is that to, you know, create something that's going to outlast you, you know, something that our children, maybe grandchildren, can look after, maybe, if they're interested in it.
Your legacy.
Yep.
Last question. What should chocolate lovers know about chocolate or chocolate making that they may not be aware of?
Oh, I don't know. Don't eat too much of it. It's good, but there are other, you know, food groups, and you also need protein. And I don't know. Seriously. It really depends on the type of chocolate you're talking about. I think, you know, the ethical aspect of chocolate making have been discussed at length. You know, all the forced labor and stuff like that. I think the expectation that, you know, you can have chocolate at any price as long as it's cheap is something that's really, really damaging. So I think it's really important that, you know, if people care about their chocolate, they should care about where the cacao that goes into their chocolate comes from. I'm not saying everybody can afford a $10 bar of chocolate, and I'm not trying to say, you know, every bar of chocolate should be priced at $10, but you know, people should care about if they can afford to, where the chocolate comes from.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sam, thank you so much. This has been an absolute privilege.
Simran, thank you very much.
Podcast listeners, you can learn more about Maru on their website, maruchocolate.com. You can also order the Doc Luck bar we tasted as part of our Maker Series tasting pack, featuring all 9 of the bars in the series. It's offered exclusively through chocolopolis.com. Check our website, theslowmelt.com, for all details, dates of the promotion, and discount codes. To hear shows on biodiversity in chocolate and what it means to empower farmers in the places where cacao is grown, check out the Slow Melt episodes on our website, or find us on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and nearly every podcast platform. You can also find us on Twitter and Instagram at @theslowmelt. The Slow Melt Maker Series is mixed and produced by Katie Ranke, with guidance from Sean Corey Campbell, and written and edited by me, Simran Sethi, with support from Sasha Woodruff. Our title track, Soldier, is written and performed by The Slackers. Join us week after next for a Maker Series episode featuring Columbia maker Cacao Hunters and another fantastic tasting session. And if you like what you're hearing, please tell your friends, consider giving us a review and or a donation, and subscribe through your favorite podcast app. Chuck of love and thanks for all your support.